Wednesday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. A bunch of games to talk about today. But before we get to that, I just want to thank everyone for listening and remind you that you can follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. I try to tweet during games when I'm watching them and give you a little preview usually about what the show's going to be about. And Danny as well, Danny LaRue. Say hello, Danny.
Hey, how are you doing, Nate?
Yes. I really am just the worst ever in the world. Intros is like, oh yeah, let's change it up this time. We'll like give our Twitter handles at the beginning and just so not smooth.
What's funny
at
is
all,
like I could do it if you wanted me to.
You think you're better than me?
At this? Among very few other things, yes.
Yeah, that's quite possible.
As somebody asked us today, asked us today on Twitter, I am not better than you at basketball at all. But this is a more open question.
Are you better than me at skiing?
Right now you're definitely better. All time, my best might be better. I don't know. I don't know how good you were when you were younger.
Not very good.
Okay, so then yes.
6'6" is not particularly conducive to the slopes. Anyway, one of the other things I had was a reminder to ask people to give us an iTunes rating. Maybe I shouldn't say that now because this might be the worst opening that we've ever done. And to alleviate that, let's talk about some basketball. Let's get to the news.
Yeah, so what kind of was one of the bigger things for me is that Goran Dragic has a bad calf strain. Manny Navarro of the Miami Herald talked about it, and he's out today. They're getting whooped by the Clippers, and Pablo Prigioni is going off. I believe he had 8 steals when we're starting to record this. And Dragic is a guy who we saw earlier this week who is, in my eyes, incredibly important to Miami's success.
He'd been playing a lot better. He's shooting, I think, 52% on threes in January for the spacing challenged Heat, and he actually is going to miss. He was sent home, actually, to Miami, so he's going to miss at least 3 games, including this Clippers game. They looked really bad with him out. And at one point in the game, they had 18 turnovers. You mentioned those ridiculous steals by Prigioni to 5 turnovers for the Clippers. So, yeah, that could be potentially damaging. The Heat have had a ton of home games so far this year. This was really their first road test. They have not looked very good at all on this road trip. I shouldn't say that. They had a nice effort against the Warriors, but I think they're now – did they beat Phoenix or did they lose Phoenix? They beat Phoenix, right? Yeah,
I believe so.
Yeah, so they're 1-3 now on this trip. And without Dragic, they're actually kind of missing Mario Chalmers a little bit. So that's and calf strains are the type of things that can linger. It's supposedly not a tear, which I'm not sure exactly what that means, because basically any kind of a strain is a tear. It's just a smaller one. Yeah, I mean, a completely torn calf. I don't know that I've ever even actually heard of that before. More really negative health news for the Pelicans. I think this is the biggest one to me.
I think
Quincy Pondexter now out for the season. He is having another surgery on that troublesome left knee. All that we've really heard is essentially that it's cartilage cleanup. And that actually sounds suspiciously like it might be microfracture. And you'll remember the story with Pondexter. He actually asked the training staff not to give him an MRI down the end of last year, played extremely well, shot over 40% on threes, had a decent series against the Warriors. And then all that we heard about the eventual surgery that he had in May was a laundry list of issues. The fact that he took almost 9 months to even come back, and they were talking about him coming back in the next 1 to 2 weeks, and apparently now it just wasn't happening. And so he's got to go under the knife again, and more evidence now that really the Pels should begin taking. So, of course, they went and won by 20 against the Kings tonight.
And because, of course, they're the luckiest, healthiest team in the world, despite winning that game by running away, they also lost Tyreek Evans in that game, though not for hopefully as long as Quincy Pondexter.
Oh, yeah. Did he actually go out of the game?
Yeah, he played 5 minutes and then he got pulled, and then now he's getting his right knee drained.
Yeah, and he had missed a couple games earlier. He said that he was feeling sharp pains in it, although he did play reasonably well against the Lakers. He's actually shooting better on threes. He credits keeping his guide hand a little bit straighter and a few more form adjustments for that. But, he's another guy where you think, all right, might be time to shut him down pretty quickly here too. And I mean, maybe they're going to try and make one more run here now that they've won this game against the Kings, or theoretically their competition, but I mean, they're out of it. They're done. Like, there's just no way.
It's just it's unrealistic at this point. I mean, they're so far, especially with, I think Utah is getting kind of closer to being on the right path, though. And, I mean, not every night, you know, but just on the aggregate. And they have to go over a lot of teams. And that's not to say that they're, you know, inferior to all of them, but it's a long road to go. And they're in such a precarious spot now just with injuries. You know, if they lost Davis for 10 games, if they lost Drew Holiday for 5 to 10 games, you know, like that kind of a thing, which is eminently realistic with this team, makes them kind of sunk. So I'm not saying you should definitively tank at this point, but you just should prioritize your guys being healthy over, you know, gunning it for every single thing.
Moving on to another perpetually healthy team, Byron Scott had some quotes today that Kobe Bryant, with his strained right Achilles, I believe that's the opposite one of the one that he tore, said that trainer Gary Vitti wants to shut Bryant down for 1 to 2 weeks, but Scott laughed and said that he doesn't see that happening.
Yeah, they don't have football trainers. Like, this isn't an issue of questioning the aptitude of the people. Like, I just saw that and went, wait, you're allowed to do that? Like, it's so crazy, and the reasoning is not, you know, they're gunning for a playoff berth or anything. It's so he can entertain the fans on his retirement tour.
Yeah, maybe so, but, you know, I think this gets to the root of the problem, and we always say, oh, their training staff is bad, they have all these injuries. Well, it really is an organizational problem. Like you'll remember 2-3 years ago, the hashtag Fred cleared him for the Bulls, for Fred Tedeschi, who was the Bulls trainer at the time, was hilarious because they had all of these ridiculous injuries and guys playing when they shouldn't have been playing and getting injured, and Omer Oshik playing on a broken. I mean, I wrote a whole piece about it, like, when I first started writing in 2012, and it wasn't good, but he still won, like, Trainer of the Year from, like, the National Association of Trainers, and I felt like that was sort of a tacit dig at the Bulls organization and maybe at the coaching staff that, you know, the training staff can say whatever they want, but if the organization doesn't listen to them or the player is allowed to overrule the training staff, one of those two things appears to be the case here with the Lakers, then it doesn't matter how good the training staff is. It's the organizations that really invest in the training staff and empower them. Amino Hassan talks all the time about how the trainers had power to fine players for not doing their corrective exercises, for example. Like, all of that working in lockstep is what really can make for a healthy team.
Well, and that goes in with something you and I have talked about before, about how sometimes it can be hard to separate the general manager from ownership. And, you know, when you're the one who signs the check, the buck eventually stops with you. And you don't usually think about that from the health and wellness side, but it's certainly true.
All right, this is an interesting one. The NCAA has moved the early entry deadline to May 25th, which is about back where it was before, I think, 2009, when they changed it to something preposterously early. It was basically like, it might have even been like 5 days after the deadline to even enter the draft is what it used to be. And the reason it used to be that way is because the spring signing period, coaches in college wanted to know what their roster was going to be. And so it was basically all focused on coaches and not helping out the players. Now, with it being May 25th, I think it's either like 7 to 10 days after the NBA scouting combine is like what the official language is. So that means that now players are going to get a chance to evaluate their NBA stock. They also are going to be you're only allowed to like do like 8 hours or something of skill work with a coach. That actually, for a player who has put his name into the draft, during that period, he's allowed to then stay on campus and work with the coaching staff at his school, like the same number of hours that you could during the regular season. And the hope is that that'll encourage guys to finish up their studies. A lot of guys kind of drop out, you know, towards the end of that year because they want to just go train, and then also keep them away from agents in the event that they do actually want to return to school. There won't be any amateurism issues. So although I think that, you know, my feelings on college basketball are well known, I think this is a step in the right direction for fairness for college players who want to be able to test the waters, not make a bad decision, and return to school, even though I think probably going is even if you're going to just go overseas and make hundreds of thousands of dollars, is a better option than staying.
Yeah, I think that I'm obviously happy if the NCAA has better policies than they had. That is a benefit that will actually be tangible to certain individuals, but it's hard for me to get super enthused about it just because I think the overall system is so weirdly tilted and just doesn't really create the structure. And I mean, my whole thing is the issue also with the making kids go to college and the structure, but that's a separate issue for a separate time. So yay, good for the NCAA for making it a little bit better. I'm never going to criticize that part of it, but everything else is everything else.
One other thing, the Celtics, they won tonight. We're not going to have a chance to talk about that game. I don't think either of us watched much of it, but they beat the Pacers at home. Jared Sullinger returned to the starting lineup. Although Kelly Olynyk at the four was what we had wanted to see, they were not effective in that alignment, even though it seemed to make sense. Kelly really struggled defensively. He got lit up by Kristaps Porzingis last night. If you watch the highlights, you're able to see that he was just getting lost on three after three. And so they went back to Sullinger, and they started playing better. One of the big problems was their defensive rebounding was really bad. They were only getting about 65% of their defensive rebounds when it was Johnson and Olynyk in the game during that stretch, which obviously is horrendous, and Sullinger is a better rebounder than Olynyk is, and that's Kevin O'Connor's piece on a Celtics blog is where I got that from.
I was watching the end of this game live, and do you know what happened? It was insane.
No, I do not know what happened.
So the Pacers, I believe the Pacers were up like 3 or 4 points with about 2 minutes to go, and the Celtics won the game by something like 5, and they only had one basket in half court. All of the other ones were steals and buckets.
No, the Celtics won by 9.
They won by 9. Okay, so but at least once it got out of hand, it was all on steals and buckets. I think they had 4 or 5 steals in the last minute and a half. And
they are, you know, as you've noted before on the 15 and 60, they are the highest turnover forcing team in the league.
They are, but like to basically have your entire offense, because something I've noticed with them the last couple games that I've watched them, which we'll talk about when we do them 15-60, is in late in games, their half-court offense really struggles, and one way to get around that is to just never have to be in a half-court offense.
Agreed. So one thing I wanted to talk about before we get into the games. In the past years, ESPN has had the Hollinger playoff odds. They finally now have a new product that they call BPI, which I know Ben Alomar, who used to work for Cleveland and Oklahoma City and now works for ESPN, has been involved with. Basically, it's uses how a team has played during the season, but it's also a little more complex. It also includes some preseason expectations and projections. Basically, it's just one organization's attempt to kind of see how the season is going to play out. So they have win projections and chances of making the playoffs. And I think it's just interesting to take a look at this. Although we're thinking that like Utah, Sacramento, Portland are all kind of in it there for that last spot. BPI has Utah with an 83% chance of getting that last eighth spot. Or of making the playoffs. We don't know about the eighth spot. And then Sacramento, 18%, Portland, 14.5%, and then you go down to New Orleans at 4%. So really, this projection at least sees this West playoff race as, if not over, because teams could start playing a lot differently, just based on the results so far this season, that very likely Utah will make the playoffs and the Kings don't have nearly as good of a chance as a lot of people would seem to think.
And that's not necessarily an issue of the model just being super strong on one or two teams, because when you look at the East, they have a lot more balance. You know, the East teams, there are a couple in the 70s, then there's some in the 20s and teens. And so it's not just like the model just picks a team and rides it. That's just the way that they see this shaking out.
You know, and I'm actually surprised at how stratified the East is, too. There's a cutoff with Detroit. Which currently projected to be the eighth seed, get 44 wins. They have a 74.5% chance of making it. And then you go down to Charlotte, projected for 40 wins with 24.2. I would guess that Charlotte and Orlando, both of whom are projected a little bit lower, a lot of the reason that they are projected lower is their preseason projections are probably lower, since those teams have kind of surprised. I do think that Charlotte, especially with how they had that great win tonight, and now that they're playing at home and they're back healthy again. I would give them a higher chance than that, but they are a little bit behind Detroit, so they've got some ground to make up as well. But I think it's interesting to look at how much less of a race this, at least one advanced stats tool, sees this than really the common perception and really my own perception before I looked at this.
And I think for me, what's clarified it is just that I don't think Sacramento's that good. You know, I think that where it's really come down is you think about, okay, how is one of these teams going to beat all the teams in the West by, let's say, 5 or 6 games moving forward? And the most obvious way is still there, which is that one of the other teams has a catastrophic injury and just can't sustain what they've already done. But to me, Utah and Houston are two of the most clear examples in the conference of teams that should outperform their first half and their second half, just because both of them had specific kind of disasters in it. And so if you're relying on that, and then you have to say, well, what have then? Yeah, New Orleans and Sacramento to various degrees because of injuries have been non-representative. Maybe Portland too because of Damian Lillard, but they're not that much better. You know, the margin that they'll have to go over is big, but you also have to account for random variance. You know, just because I'm not as high on Portland doesn't mean that I'm right. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see whether their clarification, like where they see it already, the markings will continue, and that's part of the fun of this.
All right, before we move on to our next game, please hold on for a brief word from our sponsors. Let's get to that Charlotte-Atlanta game. Charlotte had a really rough West Coast swing that coincided with Batum being out, a couple of other injuries here and there. They got right back to it at home. They have a great home court advantage there, they just destroyed the Hawks. The Hawks brought it back to a tie at one point late in the first, but for probably 90% of this game, Charlotte was up by 10 or more. And, really their defense was outstanding. They held Atlanta to 84 points in this game.
Yeah, and if you said one player on the Hornets had 6 points and 10 assists and another player had 23 points and 5 assists, you might say Nikola Batum and Kemba Walker, but I don't think you'd say them in the right order.
Yeah, Batum was fantastic. Even when his shot wasn't going down in the first half, those 10 assists, he was finding guys on back cuts, found Cody Zeller a couple of times. Zeller had one of his best games of the season with 19 points and 10 rebounds, shot 6 out of 10, got to the foul line a lot too. He's a guy who depends a lot on getting to the foul line. That was always one of the reasons that the statistical translations liked him coming out of Indiana, but he is a guy who struggles to finish in the paint a lot. And so if he can get foul calls on those plays, that really helps him a lot because he does attack the rim pretty aggressively. And he also was able to get a couple of and-ones in this game. Part of that is because this is a Hawks team that does not have a ton of athleticism to really bother him when he was going to the rim, and he was able to take advantage of that very nicely.
And one thing that was really surprising to me about this, and you can speak to it more having watched more of it, is that with the kind of the strengths and weaknesses of these teams, you would think, oh, you know, maybe Charlotte kept it close with their bench and, you know, their starters had a couple runs. But this game, the starters were huge and the backups largely, you know, let ground go. And that's not what you'd expect considering the Hawks starters.
Yeah. And a lot of that was just, you know, there was pretty extensive garbage time in this game as well. And the Hawks really made the only run of the game that they did against some of the backups in that late in the first quarter. But yeah, it was just the Hawks backups generally did not do too well in this game. I mean, I know that a couple of them were in the green from a plus minus standpoint, but Schroeder and the Hawks mix and match their starters a little bit more than some teams do. Schroeder was 3 out of 13. Jeff Teague 3 out of 10. So 6 out of 23 combined from those guys. And I thought that was very telling because in combination, Al Horford was only 1 out of 4. And what Charlotte was doing was Horford will get a lot of his shots on pick and pops. And so Charlotte was switching that and then just forcing those guards to go one-on-one against a guy like Zeller or Marvin Williams, who had an excellent game and has improved his athleticism in this contract year. So he was able to do a pretty decent job against those guys, and really Teague and Schroeder were not able to get great shots. They were laying off them, either going under on the screen on the pick and roll or just forcing them into jumpers out of ISO situations, and that is the formula that we've seen be successful against this Hawks team time and again, the second half of last year, the playoffs, and now this year.
Something that I've been wondering about the last little bit is Cody Zeller. I think we're reaching the point where he's definitely a good basketball player, but where do you see his role on a successful team like the Hornets could very well be by the end of the year?
Yeah, it's an interesting call, right? He tries hard. He's got a high motor. He's very fast in a straight line. He and Kaminsky are kind of both like this, actually, though Zeller has more athleticism than Kaminsky does, especially leaping ability, but they both have kind of short arms. Zeller is not like a great shooter, so he could play the four sometimes, maybe next to Al Jefferson, maybe like actually getting to where he can shoot three-pointers and make them regularly or even make long twos regularly, which he hasn't really been able to do yet in his career. That's going to be important for him. He's been starting at center now with Jefferson out, and I always felt like he was a little bit better at that, but with the short arms, again, not the greatest rim protector. He's a pretty decent pick and roll defender. He can move in space pretty well, run the floor really well, also decent in pick and roll, though he struggles to finish. You know, he's kind of a 4.5 in a lot of ways, but I think you can be effective with him. He's starting to develop more as a smarter player. So yeah, it'll be interesting. He'll be a very interesting extension candidate next year. I think he is a solid player, but you know, you might say if you want to really be a contender, you would want to upgrade at that spot if he's your center or power forward.
But at the same time, I think that if you just put him in there and said, okay, you're going to play 20 minutes a game, we can pencil you in for that at one of the big man spots, you could do a lot worse. And that's why I think he has value. But it's also, as you said, as an extension candidate, that's tough to monetize, especially with where the market is going to be going. It's just sitting there like, if I were his agent or whoever, I think just finding a number would be brutal for him.
One quick note, I mean, this is not really with the theme of this game. Frank Kaminsky, just looking at his season-long stats, 38% from the field, 32% on threes, taking about a third of his shots from three, maybe a little bit more than that. And 25 offensive rebounds on the season, so he's not really a guy who is spending a ton of time inside. It'll be interesting. I still think that his fate is as a center as well offensively, but then whether he can hold up defensively. He and Zeller are very similar players, and maybe you can say they can work together and they kind of, you know, both. At least you can switch everything and have the same guy if it's a 4-5 type of thing. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with Kaminsky. He has had some moments and has moved his feet better and been a little bit better at driving at times than I thought he might be. He's improved his quickness more than I necessarily thought he could, but, you know, the production has not been there the way you would hope for a guy who is 22.
And what's hard is when you think about the kind of ideal guy to pair with Kaminsky, Zeller to a point, you know, you want one of those guys who has a little bit of range on his jump shot but can at least be a weak side shot blocker. And there's only one Serge Ibaka, sadly. We can't clone him and give him around to the league to every team that needs a guy like him, but there are a lot of them.
Yeah, and someone that I want to talk about more on the 15 and 60 when we talk about the Hornets later this week is Kemba Walker, who is really having a wonderful season, someone that we kind of have thought of as, you know, maybe a fully formed player, just not that sexy, kind of middle of the road point guard, but he has really improved his production, and he had a wonderful game in this one. He was 9 out of 13, 4 of 6 on threes for those 23 points that you mentioned, and, you know, he is improved enough now where he's a real threat off the dribble, shooting jumpers in pick and roll, which, you know, he kind of hasn't been in past years.
Do you want to move on to Nets-Knicks, the Battle of New York?
Shockingly, this was a really entertaining game, which would, you know, you would think, all right, the Nets have lost Jared Jack. Maybe that is the reason, actually, that could be a little bit more entertaining. This was their first game under the interim coach. Is it Tony Moore? Is that his name?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. A guy who I think played and coached like 14 NBA teams or something like that. Thad Young had some quotes after the game, as you'll often hear when the team, you know, gets this kind of dead cat bounce under an interim coach of, oh, you know, we were playing so much freer. He's like really encouraging and, you know, sort of like a little bit of subtweeting of Hollins there for, you know, being a little bit more of a taskmaster. We'll see how it continues to go. But the Nets did have a nice win, and Carmelo was out for this game. And you might say, oh, that's what the problem was. They're missing him. But they gave up $110 to the Nets, and you can't blame that on Carmelo being out.
And also, one of the curious things to me about this game is that New York played last night. They played against the Celtics, and they still only had an 8-man rotation that was really only a 7-man rotation. So whether it was that Fisher just didn't trust the other guys or whatever, and I didn't see a ton of this game, but the parts I saw, it looked like they were more tired than they usually are.
Well, no, it was an 8-man rotation. Vujicic only played like
Sorry, I miscounted. It was 8, sort of not. It was 8, technically 9. I was not 7, technically.
Yeah. I mean, Derek Williams was brilliant in this game. Kept them in it. Had all kinds of nice moves, whether it was off the dribble, shooting jumpers. He got to the line for 11 free throw attempts. He had this one drive for a spin move. He dunked all over Thaddeus Young. Really, I mean, probably the best game of his career, frankly. Although, down the stretch, he and Lance Thomas were both trying to guard ISO Joe Johnson, or maybe pick and roll Joe Johnson in this case. Couldn't do it. That was really the deciding factor down the stretch. It was 96-94 Nets, and then the Nets ran off about either 6 or 8 straight points, all of which were created by Johnson in pick and roll, either with jumpers, or then he missed a floater, and Brooke Lopez was able to get to the offensive glass on that play because the big Robin Lopez had to rotate out to Johnson.
Keep trying to boost his trade value, Brooklyn. And by that boost, I mean make his trade value because he has none right now.
Yeah. Thad Young also had a pretty nice game for the Nets, 9 out of 18, and he actually left some points on the table too, because he still has no right hand at all. That really hurts him trying to finish. A lot of times he will catch the ball sort of in a pick and roll situation or a dump off on the right side of the basket. And when a 7-footer is coming over, just the ability to get that shot up with the right hand is pretty crucial, but he would have to just either not shoot it or bring it back into the guy. So he missed 2 or 3 attempts there, but overall a really nice game. Someone tweeted at me that he and Julius Randle actually have very similar games. And despite the fact that Julius is, at least offensive games, that Julius has probably like 40 pounds on Thad, it's actually, I think it's kind of true. You know, no right hand, kind of slither around, try to ISO and drive. But, you know, Thad's obviously a much better player than Julius is. But just from like a stylistic standpoint, I thought that was
interesting. And they have a similar amount of faith in their jumpers. It's just that Thaddeus Young's is way better.
Yeah, that's true. You know, Thaddeus was taking threes a lot last year when he first came over the Nets and was shooting at really kind of a career best rate, and then he hasn't been shooting very many jumpers this year. It's kind of been more like the slithering inside stuff that we've come to know from him. Porzingis was 5 out of 17 in this game. He was able to make some plays off the dribble by pump faking, taking a couple of dribbles, kind of getting a shoulder into the guy, knocking him backwards, and then shooting over him. He had a couple of impressive plays there. Really, though, he struggled in kind of that dead zone, that 3 to 10 foot range. Had a bunch of red on his shot chart from there. I think he missed probably 7 or 8 shots in that area. And you know, he's shooting 37%, which is a league average, about 40% from there. And you know, he was bumped. He had some plays where he's kind of going away from the rim. So maybe he will be able to make those shots ultimately. I don't know. It's not an area that a lot of guys are able to be efficient in. But he was not able to make those tonight, and that was to the Knicks' detriment.
One of my concerns with him that I have more hope on now than before is the idea that if somebody closes out hard to the three, that he can pump fake or whatever, draw the guy, take 1 or 2 dribbles, and instead of taking that shot, which I think he'll struggle with, make a pass. And he was never a great assist guy when he was playing for Sevilla. But if he can do that, just like basically wait for somebody to get open and just make the easiest pass possible that is decent, that would be huge for them. Because I think, like, to a certain point, when you're dealing with a big who can shoot, if they can hit that, that just unlocks a couple extra facets to the offense that can really work, especially if they build the right team around him.
Donald Sloan and Wayne Ellington actually started at guard in this game, but Bojan Bogdanović came out off the bench to have one of his best games. He had 14 points on 6 shooting possessions, and Shane Larkin had 17 points on 12 shooting possessions against his old team. There are a ton of Knicks fans there. Apparently, they're really booing Shane Larkin. I don't know what you have against the poor Shane Larkin, who got his rookie option declined by the Knicks. Maybe they just were sad that Tyson Chandler got traded for him.
Maybe it's Mets fans that are bitter about his dad doing stuff against them. I don't know.
this is really a disappointing loss, though, for the Knicks, even though it was on the second end of a back-to-back, even though it was without Carmelo. I mean, if you're looking at it objectively, that's probably about a 50-50 game for this Knicks team. And they ended up losing to a Brooklyn team that was inspired. And it was a good crowd atmosphere, though, with a ton of Knicks fans at Barclays Center. So exciting game. There were a lot of great dunks in this game. I was shocked that I was sort of like dreading having to watch the Nets because I haven't watched them in a while. And I was just like, all right, I have a responsibility to watch them. But I really enjoyed this one.
The other loser in this, as I feel like I want to mention every time Brooklyn wins a game because I know how much they relish the losses, is the Boston Celtics, because, of course, that makes the possibility of their pick a little bit worse.
Yeah, and especially they got to be agreed because the Knicks actually just beat the Celtics last night. So it's like, you know, you could switch it up, Knicks, like win, lose yesterday, win today. Washington, Milwaukee, I saw probably about the last third of this game or so. And my biggest takeaway, as it was also when Washington beat the Bulls in a game that we didn't recap, but I saw a bit of over the weekend, is that Nene, when he is there, still can be a very effective player. Gortat was out for this game, and Nene was fantastic. Really just defensively flummoxed Milwaukee quite a bit, and you know was also with his hard rolls to the rim and kind of his sneaky, like really fast drives that he'll do on occasion. You know, I think that was encouraging for Washington, and hopefully he doesn't get hurt again soon. But I think that having him back could be a real boon for them.
Yeah, and I for some reason, I remember back to when I used to cover them more frequently, I do like the way he plays offensively with better surrounding talent. Like, he's not better than Gortat. I'm not saying he should, you know, that he should get starters minutes or anything like that, but there are certain centers who I think you can do a little bit more with them offensively like that. We've talked about it a little bit with Bogut. And Nene offensively is like that. Defensively, you know, I think he's just a solid player when he's healthy. And so he can be an important part of this team. And as I've kind of alluded to before, I am not willing to sell yet on this team. They're close. They're real close. But also Bradley Beal played in this game.
Yeah, did not really play much down the stretch. It seems like they're just trying to work him back into it. I didn't see him play at all, actually, during the portion that I watched.
Did you see his quote today?
Oh, that it was basically like, was that the one you tweeted about, like his agent can't be happy with us?
Yeah, because he basically said there's a possibility. I think he was speaking off the cuff, you know, it's not one of those like this is a definitive statement, but he said something about like how he might need to watch his minutes the rest of his career. And when you're a guy who hasn't gotten your first big NBA contract and you say that right before, I can just imagine an agent, just his brain exploding just a little bit.
Jabari Parker had a very Jabari Parker kind of game. 22 points, 9 of 13 from the field, 4 of 5 from the foul line, only 4 defensive rebounds in his 32 minutes, and negative 17. Nobody else on the Bucks was any worse than minus 5 in this game. And Jabari, though I still really believe in his potential as a scorer, he is coming back off the injury. Just defensively, he really... They want to switch, and he seems like a guy who should be able to switch, but he just is not capable of doing it. I mean, if you watch the highlights of this game, you'll see John Wall had this awesome lefty dunk where he just got him on a switch and just one simple crossover just blew right by him. And then he had another of what I'm going to start calling Jabari specials, where he's kind of there at the rim to challenge someone and just kind of takes a swipe at the ball or like makes a wild attempt at the block and just jumps out of the way and lets the guy get an easy shot. You know, I mean, he has a big body, and if he were able to just get that body in front of people and go straight up, people are going to bounce off him and not be able to finish. But he just is so far away from showing that kind of intelligence defensively. It's a little discouraging.
Yeah, I'm thinking about trying to keep an eye on their game on Friday against the Hawks, because I think that'll be a test for him in a lot of different ways defensively, of both the penetrators and of course having a great guy in Paul Millsap to probably defend most of the time.
Chris Middleton has been on fire lately. He played 42 minutes in this game, 25 points on 17 shot attempts. So I'm going to look a little bit more deeply into his performance lately for the 15 and 60 that's going to come out later this week. He played well. Giannis also had a nice game with 19 points. I mean, the Bucks did some nice things at times offensively in this game. Giannis also is one of the few guys that you'll see who actually uses his amazing length to make passes. Like, he'll drive down the lane, and because they have no spacing, obviously, those passes are all difficult, but he'll have a help defender come over, and then he'll actually reach around him and, like, whip a pass behind the guy's back, usually to Greg Monroe, for a layup, and, you know, you can only really do that because his arms are so long. That's, like, a really cool play, something to watch next time you're watching the Bucks.
Anything else on this one?
Kelly Oubre had another nice game. He is really, you know, he makes rookie mistakes defensively, but on the ball, he can be really good. I mean, he had this one great sequence where he, you know, he is slithered over a pick. He can be difficult to screen at times. He's good at that. He's got that 7'2 wingspan at his size, which is fantastic. So he slithered over a screen on Middleton and then slid with him, took the shoulder right in the chest for a charge. He's hitting his three-pointers reasonably well. You know, was trusted to play 10 minutes in this game, but was plus +9 in those 10 minutes.
There we go.
But I will say this, you know, they basically, the Hawks could have drafted him and they instead traded for the 19th pick, got a couple of second rounders and then, took Tim Hardaway. I'm going to say that the Wizards won that trade because, or maybe that the Hawks lost it because Oubre is like 4 years younger than Tim Hardaway, who never plays. And he's
also
already playing
isn't good.
And is better than Tim Hardaway.
Yeah. I'm more importantly than he's not playing is that he isn't that good.
Yeah. So definitely, I probably would have had quite a few of the guys who were drafted in that range instead of Tim Hardaway. Frankly, maybe Hardaway will still become something, but he's got a year and a half to figure it out before he becomes a free agent, which is sort of, you know, maybe if he were had had 3 years left on his rookie deal instead of two, you can countenance that trade a little bit more with the idea that, all right, this guy's got some talent. We can really rehabilitate him, but they haven't apparently made much progress yet. And, you know, time's a wasting there before he becomes a free agent.
Yeah. I'm sure the Hawks would be happy with Robert Portis Esquire or, Rhonda Hollis Jefferson at that spot.
Robert Portis Esquire. What's that?
I just like calling him that. I just think it's funny. Cause as far as I can tell, his given name is Bobby. And, like, I for some reason, I like to think of a guy's, like, full name. I don't know why. I think it goes back to Ed Maisonette does that a lot. And I was just like, wait, his actual name is Bobby. I think it is. So then I just like calling him Robert because it's not his name. I'm a weird person. You know this.
Let's move on to Golden State Denver. How about it? The Warriors lose for the third time this season. They announced before the game that Draymond Green was supposed to miss the next two games. He was in a suit this game. And they really, really missed him. Could not stop the Nuggets to save their life nearly all game. Danilo Gallinari went off. You know, I think he only made 5 field goals, but he had pretty close to 30 points. Shot 19 free throws, I think, made 17 of them. And really, that was the big problem for the Warriors. They did not have very much energy. There were a ton of plays in this game where there would be a long rebound and they just did not. And it wasn't even like the Nuggets were had just such incredible energy going after the loose balls themselves. It just would kind of bounce once and then a Nugget would get it because no Warrior really was like able to summon the effort to just sprint after it. And the Warriors ended up losing. They also started Jason Thompson and Brandon Rush in this game too, which probably, you know, when you lose by two, you kind of wonder a little bit about that decision. And yeah, all right, you know, they lost on the road to the Nuggets. They rested Green. We see him all the time in the locker room. I think that was probably a good decision. He's got ice all over his body, you know, after every game at this point.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things that are justifiable about this. You know, for me, I wrote about this a little bit. It's like, you know, it makes you appreciate what a 72-10 season is because you're facing teams that are generally going up for your games and just variance, you know, when you're facing teams that are talented, especially on the road, things like that happen. But when you start Jason Thompson and Brandon Rush, you're not really doing yourself too many favors. And there are a couple of different...
Yeah, Thompson at the four.
Yeah, Thompson at the four and only playing Festus Ezeli 6 minutes. And so you're not making this sort of like a trade-off or something like that. They were doing a series of kind of strange things like that. While I think Luke Walton has done a lot of things well, very well, rotations to me have not been one of his strengths. I've whined about it on Warriors World before. And that kind of the idea of, you know, just playing more, being more afraid of the opponent's strengths than your own strengths. And when you're the Warriors, you can impose your will on anybody.
Yeah, I like that. Like, what? Yeah, being more afraid of the opponent's strengths than your own strengths. Now, maybe the thinking was, look, we got to go with two bigs at some point in this game. with Draymond out. I mean, I don't think of Draymond as a big. He plays like a small. He shoots threes. I'm talking about guys who don't shoot threes. Our second unit just gets crushed when we go with two bigs when Steph is out. Steph and Clay being in there with the two bigs, we can at least, like, there'll be enough shooting. Maybe we can kind of deal with it. And we know that the Nuggets are going to start each half with Fareed at the four and a traditional center. So we'll at least be matched up, because the Nuggets a lot of times will go small on the second unit as well, and especially have against the Warriors. So I think, you know, the more I think about it, I think I understand why they did it that way. And Thompson, you know, never came back in after the initial stint. So, I mean, you could say, all right, they should have just started Iguodala, started Barnes, you know, start your best guys, especially when Green is out, if you really want to win the game. But maybe that wasn't the mentality so much, because it was just they didn't play Green.
The funny part about you're talking about the idea of playing the bigs is that Luke Walton wasn't involved with the team, but I was covering them then, and there is a very specific track record of Kenneth Fareed not doing a good job handling Harrison Barnes at power forward. Like, this is a thing that happened and is arguably part of the reason why Andre Iguodala is on the Warriors, was that they, when they made that sort of adjustment due to injury, the Nuggets never really got it right. And I understand the pressure and all that, and it's the same for me. It's a parallel to the logic of, oh, Brook Lopez is in the game, so we can't go small. It's just like, you know, you're better than the other team is, so make them adjust. But I understand it. It's just a difference of opinion.
And if we're gonna bitch about this, it's only fair to note that Rush was +8,
yeah,
in 19 minutes, and Thompson was +3 in his 13 minutes. So it's hard to say that that's what lost them the game. Maybe they could have taken more of a lead. It was sort of Livingston, Azili, those were the guys who were in the minus. And Steph actually was negative for his second straight game, despite going for 38 points. But really, I mean, they put up .110, although they struggled from the three-point line until Steph's late barrage, which was pretty breathtaking in the fourth quarter as they tried to come back. And this is a terrifying team to try to hold a lead against. Even with Draymond out, but they just couldn't stop the Nuggets. And you see, I mean, Draymond was, everyone seems to have kind of forgotten because he's improved so much offensively this year, but he was the second in defensive player of the year. I thought he should have been first last year, for a reason. And he's so important to everything that they do defensively.
And one of the big ways that you could see this in a variety of different defensive settings was Danilo Gallinari going off. And Gallinari had 28 points. He shot 19 free throws and made 17 of them, which is remarkable in a couple of different ways.
Yeah, I said that already. You were doing something
else.
Oh,
okay. Well, what I wanted to go in with then with that was the idea of, it is just this weird thing in my brain that I remember that Gallinari, it seems like he always does well against the Warriors, and it's true, he does. He has almost a 20-point-a-game scoring average against the Warriors, which is more than against any other team.
This was we talked about this about a month ago on a 15 and 60 on the Nuggets, that this is just the microcosm of how Gallinari causes problems and what you need to do to defend him. He was 5 of 14 from the field, but just got to the line at will. They just could not stop fouling him, and it's so frustrating because it's not like you have to sell out for the block on this guy. He shoots a miserable percentage within 3 feet, but he's just so good at getting the contact. And that was really, and also a big problem for the Warriors is when they foul, that then they cannot get out onto their fast break. They usually do well when teams kind of are starting to get tired, when there aren't any stoppages for a while, and it really lets the everything get slowed down a little bit.
Do you want to talk about Clay's almost dribble, or are we just going to let that pass?
Nah, we can let that pass. He dribbled right after they had a chance to advance the ball, and if you dribble before you call a timeout, then you can't advance the ball. This is after Gallo missed a free throw that could have given him a three-point lead, and then Clay ultimately missed the potential winning three. Steph had a chance to win the game or at least tie the game, and I think he really, really wanted to try and win the game because they got a stop. He came down. He had Gallo on the switch, and Gallo was absolutely not going to give up a three, and Steph really wanted a three. I think he could have just blown by him and gotten the tying two, but he just was not interested in that. So he ended up turning it over. Gallo made a great play, dove on the floor, and then, you know, it was time to foul for the Warriors. Let's talk about the Nuggets, though, in this game. I think a game that a lot of their guys, other than Gallo, really showed some flashes.
Yeah, certainly. I think that, you know, you can see it in a lot of different guys. I thought that, you know, Moutier didn't do everything perfectly, but you could see he had some nice little defensive effort. I'm trying to think, like, I don't think anybody particularly, Darrell Arthur continuing to make, like, seemingly
yeah,
every bit of
jump
shot.
Yeah, that was the one that I was going to point to, because he was hitting his jump shot, and he played a lot of center. Like, their closing lineup that the Warriors couldn't stop was Arthur at center and Gallo at the four, and you can argue the efficacy of playing Andrew Bogut against that unit, but, you know, instead of maybe just going with Barnes at center, which they did a little bit, but with Arthur hitting his shots, he's so valuable defensively with how he's able to get out and shooters, switch. He's like their best talker defensively as well. Like, he's always been a great defensive player. He just can't shoot to save his life. If he could just hit jump shots regularly, he would be an awesome player.
Yeah, and every once in a while he has one of those games because he has a lot of confidence in it, but just sometimes it doesn't fall. And the other guy who I want to talk about with this is Will Barton. I thought Barton was more aggressive getting to the basket. He's more comfortable doing that than he used to be, and he had a nice overall game.
Yeah, he was. And he's just the versatility of his three-point shooting. He was 2 of 5 on threes, all above the break shots that were pretty tough shots where he can kind of go behind the screen. I mean, that's just a skill that he had not flashed at all, and is able to create a shot, get out in transition. Just a hard guy to stop, and a guy that the Warriors have really had trouble with in those games that we've seen. And then Gary Harris also had a wonderful game. He bedeviled the Warriors with back cuts on penetration. When guys would penetrate along the baseline, he was able to get to the rim. He shot 7 of 14, had 19 points, and played pretty good D as well on Klay Thompson. Thompson had 17 points, but only was able to get 13 shot attempts off, which is kind of the more important thing with him a lot of times. And
he also had a couple big offensive rebounds.
Yeah, no, that was true, too. I mean, and you know, there were some interesting choices here. Festus playing so little, you know, instead Spates getting the backup minutes in the first half when he went 0 for 5. That wasn't really too good either. Sean Livingston did not have a good game as well. He was scoreless in 16 minutes. Disappointing for any of us like me. I mean, I would like to see the Warriors set the record, even though I grew up in Chicago. I just think it's something really cool to witness, and kind of hard to do that when you lose on the road to the Nuggets, and now they are a mere 2.5 games ahead of San Antonio. And I think the other lesson here, too, is just with Curry out, when Klay has been out on occasion or not himself, or when Draymond now has been out, the Warriors just are not the same team. They are not able to make up for the loss of one of those three guys and still play at that same machine-like level the way the Spurs can.
Yeah, I think that's the big lesson. And what's incredible about, yeah, the Warriors lost, and so now they're tied for the best start of this many games in NBA history, and that they're only 2.5 games ahead of the Spurs, who have generally, they've been more diligent about resting their guys and all that stuff. For them to be that close is pretty astonishing.
Jazz Blazers. The Blazers won 99-85. Early on, this was just an absolute rock fight. I think it was 38-34 at the half. And then the Blazers were able to pull away in the third quarter. One of my takeaways here, the hope was that Utah was really going to be coming back now with Rudy Gobert. And he had some great defensive moments at times, especially in the first half. He's still kind of limited minutes. He played 24 minutes in this game. But he and Jeff Withey, the centers for the Jazz, combined to go 1 for 11, despite the fact that those guys never shoot outside of 3 feet.
Yeah, and that gets compounded when Derek Favors isn't in, and Lyles had a nice shooting game for him. Oh, yeah, nice shooting game for anybody. But you just can't that's too hard, especially when you
it was a big problem, especially against Portland's scheme, because what they want to do is lay back on the pick and roll, leave their big as close to the basket as possible. And so if the small for Portland was able to get around the screen at all, they would try to throw it to Gobert or Withey, and those guys coming down the lane, if there was a guy in between them and the basket, they just do not have the craft to finish. There's no chance of like a floater or something like that. Gobert would try to go strong, but is not necessarily going to dunk on people like that. Like, he doesn't have that level of explosiveness. And you know, he just sort of bumps into guys, throws some crap off the backboard, and, you know, it just looks ugly. And this has been a problem since before his injury as well, and Withy, because he is exactly the same as Gobert, except slightly worse in all facets, or significantly worse in some facets, has the exact same problem.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But yeah, you mentioned Lyles. I thought that his jump shot looks really, really good right now. He was just splashing corner threes, even like a quick release on occasion, just very, very comfortable. Still, you know, he's a 19-year-old rookie, not someone that you think of as like an effective player who's really going to be winning you games. But the fact that his jumper is coming along, I mean, that was one of the things that people pointed to coming out of Kentucky, was that he shot really poorly on jumpers. But that's one of those things where scouting has to trump it. You know, you see what a guy can do in a workout. You just see that his form is good, that he's generally a skilled player. You've watched him going back to AAU ball, and that's how you know that this guy can shoot the ball. And so his college numbers were clearly an aberration, and I think he's going to be a guy who can be a solid stretch four. The question to me, and a guy who also is skilled and can put the ball on the floor a little bit, the question to me is he going to be able to actually finish at the basket? If you put a small on him, ultimately, is he going to be able, a guy who can be versatile enough to post up? Can he switch defensively? I think he's got some pretty decent instincts there, despite a lack of explosion. So some encouraging signs from Trey Lyles. Certainly, there are some guys drafted after him, like Portis, even Campaign, who have kind of looked a little bit better so far. But, I don't think that Trey Lyles is going to be a bust if he can keep shooting like that.
And another important thing to bring up with him, and I was somebody who wasn't as big a believer in him as you were, and it's looking like you're closer to...
Yeah, I was never a big believer in him either. You know, he always just seemed like a steady guy, and a guy, if he wasn't going to be able to shoot threes, which, you know, we didn't really know, you know, could be someone who was just a guy, you know, nothing that he really did great. I mean, I wasn't, like, doing bat flicks over that pick. I thought he would be fine, yeah. But I wasn't like, oh, this is a great pick or anything.
Yeah, I was meaning it more that you were higher on him because I was super low on him. But anyway, but one of the things that I acknowledged, and I think everybody did, that's important, is the idea of a non-representative sample. And what happened with him at Kentucky was he was playing not his position, so that led to some weird stuff with his rebounding numbers, and it led to some stuff with his jump shot because he was playing a different position. He was being guarded differently, and they had no spacing on that because they were playing Lyles, Willie Cauley-Stein, and why am I forgetting the other guy?
Carl Towns.
And they were playing those guys together, and so it just didn't work. And so you have to look, as you said, you have to scout beyond that. You have to look at the mechanics of the jump shot, not just the success rate, especially with a guy like Trey Lyles. So that's another example of how scouting is different than just, you know, looking at the numbers, though of course they tell part of the story and they're an important data point in and of themselves.
For Portland, Dame Lillard just roasted Raul Neto and Trey Burke, although Burke had an okay offensive game. Lillard, really efficient, 8 out of 14, 4 of 7 on threes. Had 10 assists. He was fantastic in a third quarter in which, as Kevin Pelton tweeted, the Blazers scored 34 points on 23 possessions and really blew the game open well into double digits. The Jazz just did not have much of an answer for him. He was getting guys open threes left and right, you know, getting some nice shots for Allen Crabb, Myers Leonard. One thing I will say is Noah Vonleh starts each half for the Blazers now, and he plays like 8 minutes or so and then goes out. I mean, maybe this is a Blazers team that cares more about development this year, but he's clearly not the best option. Just starting him doesn't make a ton of sense because he just isn't as good even as Myers Leonard, even when Leonard is playing the four, not to mention some of their other options that they can use, you know, some of the smaller guys like Aminu or Harkless or something.
Yeah, and I mean Ed Davis, of course, as well. But I'm really intrigued to see what Vonleh becomes, because it's like, is he good enough to really push his way into a rotation reliably? Because right now he's doing it more, it's kind of a different thing, but if he's a guy where you feel like you have to play him 18 to 20 a night.
I will say this, though. I think the combinations do kind of make sense. Like Vonleh is a guy who can shoot a little bit, although he doesn't a ton. He was 2 out of 7 in this game, mostly around the rim. He's an okay combination with Plumlee, and then Ed Davis, the combination with Leonard. I think that is a combination that makes pretty good sense, and those guys play together a lot off the bench, and they were both pretty effective in this game as well. So, and Gerald Henderson, also a guy who had a nice game, 3 out of 3 on threes, mostly from the corner, as I recall. But Henderson, the ability to shoot threes without hesitation, if that ever really can become part of his game, and he's an accurate guy and, you know, jumps pretty high, can get his shot off from 2-point range. But if he becomes a good 3-point shooter, and maybe with guys like Dame and CJ McCollum setting him up, he can be, versus, you know, where he's been in Charlotte his whole career. That could really change his prospects significantly, because he is a quality defensive player and a strong guy as well.
I'm not necessarily saying they should start it, but a lineup I would like to see a little bit this year, just so they know what they have, is Lillard, McCollum, Henderson, Davis, and Myers-Leonard. Because I think Leonard, offensively, beyond the fact that he's actually a guy who can shoot, which is nice, I think that he benefits a lot from the creation of one or both of those guys, and that it's a better way to use it. And when you're playing, I think you're getting a lot of the advantages there that you're not getting. I'd just be intrigued to see if that lineup kind of thrives even within their level of success, because I think that might be their best five, at least for a little bit. And I love Aminu. I think Aminu is one of their five best players, but just as a cohesive unit, I'd be intrigued to see how they do.
Yeah, it's too bad that Ed Davis kind of has Kenneth Faried disease. He's sort of like, if you just look at his body, he looks like he should be a pretty mobile defender who could switch out on the perimeter and be a good pick and roll defender, but just kind of isn't.
Yeah, it's true.
You know,
maybe Aminu in the Ed Davis spot. Maybe that's the group.
Yeah, no, and they do. I mean, that would be. I mean, maybe you could cobble together enough shooting, because at least Aminu and Henderson are guys who can take a three, if not make a three, and then you've got, you know, McCollum and Lillard obviously are really good. And if it were Leonard, even, you could go with nearly a five out, run some pick and rolls with Aminu, which is something he actually did as a center sometimes in small units in Dallas and was pretty effective at. And that's a unit that might actually have a prayer of stopping somebody, which a lot of these Blazers units don't. So yeah, I like the basic idea there, to be sure.
Any other games you want to do?
Nah, I think that's it for me.
Okay. Do we want to argue about the Chris Paul trade, or wait until later?
Yeah, let's save that one for a rainy day. We've been going for like an hour here.
I thought you meant we'd go for an hour on that topic, but yeah, you're right.
Right, exactly right. Yeah, the Chris Paul trade. Like, I love how it's like, you know, you're talking about it like it's something that's happened.
I kind of wanted to give listeners a heart attack for a little bit. I just thought it'd be fun. Just so you know, if Chris Paul was ever traded, it would be the first thing we talked about. Probably.
Yeah, unless like it was the same day that Kevin Durant signed somewhere other than Oklahoma City or something. I think that's right. All right, so that'll do it for today. Hopefully now me plugging a potential iTunes rating or ranking or comment is something that will be a little bit more well-received, since we've actually given you a good show instead of some pointless banner at the start of the show. And now I will end that pointless banner and the show. Thanks so much for listening. We will talk to you all next time.